This is David's Book Talk, bringing authors and book lovers together in a unique way since 2009. Visit us at davidsbooktalk.com and join the conversation at facebook.com/davidsbooktalk. But first, pull up a chair, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Here's your host, David English.
Hello, and welcome to David's Book Talk. And we have a special guest today, John Verdon, who has written a new book, a very dark cover book, called Wolf Lake. This is the fourth in the series of David Gurney books. Hello.
Hello, David. How are you? Let me just stick one little fact in. The Wolf Lake actually now is the fifth.
Really?
Kind of amazes me, too.
Oh, it's fifth. Wow, well, did I miss one? I must have missed.
I think the fourth was Peter Pan Must Die.
All right, so the first was Think of a Number. The second was Shut Your Eyes.
Yep, then there was a third one called I'll Let the Devil Sleep.
Oh, I forgot about that one. Okay. I forgot about that one.
Well, I'm happy to be doing this so long now that I have books that people are forgetting.
Well, I think it's four of the five. I'm not sure if I have that one, so I have to check. But
yes,
anyway, it's just a fascinating series. They're just fun to read. I mean, and David Gurney is so much fun. It's Dave Gurney, but same thing, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, same thing. Well, some people call him David, too, so yes.
As soon as I said four, I thought, uh-oh, maybe it's five, you know? Anyway, but Wolf Lake is the new one,
yes,
and you're the new publisher now.
Yes, I am. Counterpoint out in Berkeley and in L.A., lovely people.
So how did you get hooked up with them, and what exactly, how did you go from, you were with Simon & Schuster at one point, weren't you?
No, we were with, actually it was the Crown Division of Random House.
Oh, Crown.
And they, Crown Division of Random House had published the first four, and shortly after the fourth one, my editor, who I'd had from the beginning, from Think of a Number, he left Random House, and at that point, we started reconsidering what we wanted to do, and we started talking to a number of publishers. And the folks out at Counterpoint really struck us as exactly the kind of people we wanted to be working with.
Interesting. Yeah, a lot of authors are like that. They like to stay with the same editors because it works. And once you find one that works, how important is an editor to you?
Oh Lord, enormously important. And the editor I had at Crown and the editor who I've got to know now through Wolf Lake, they're very different in their approach, but enormously helpful, because I don't care how good a writer is. I mean, we have blind spots, and I know one of my blind spots is, it kind of comes down to length. I mean, I tend to write long books, and they're probably, you know, an editor for me is vital, because they can take a book that's 500 pages and turn it into 400 pages, and 400 pages that are a heck of a lot better than the original 500.
Yeah, if you had to work with a new editor, I guess that would be quite a shock, unless they really knew what they were doing. Really.
I think it's a potential shock, but then it's also a kind of slowly discovered delight when you realize that the new guy has all kinds of abilities and insights that, you know, add to the process. I mean, when I finish a book, I think it kind of is the way it ought to be. And then a bright, talented editor takes a look at it and suggests a bunch of changes, and they turn out to be terrific. And then all of a sudden, you got a love affair with the new editor.
Right, exactly. But this book is so well written. I mean, you get into it and you're just so curious to see what's going to happen next. And your chapters aren't overly long, so it's easy to get into the book. You can put it down, if you're falling asleep at night, you can put it down and pick it up really easily the next day, because the chapters are so long, or
I'm
short.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. Well, it's important. You ever read a book and the chapters are so long, you feel like you have to finish the chapter and you can't get to the end of the chapter before you fall asleep?
No, I understand. It's an odd thing, David, but it's very true. I mean, you wouldn't think that a simple thing like a short chapter could help the involvement of a reader that much, but I think it absolutely does, and I've experienced it myself.
Right. Now, at one point, I think you had names for your chapters, didn't you?
I had names for the chapters, and I did that on the first four books. One of the suggestions my new editor had made was that he thought that it would be in some way kind of, it would smooth the process a little bit if I would consider not naming the chapters, but just name the parts of the book. Typically, my books are divided into four parts, and I give titles to those parts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still doing that in Wolf Lake. But I took his suggestion to remove the individual chapter titles, and I think the idea was that it would just, maybe streamline the process a little bit. And I'm always open to suggestions like that. I've come to trust other people's opinions quite a lot.
Right. Well, I must admit I like the chapter names, but I didn't notice it that much. I mean, I noticed it right away because I'm used to your books.
Mm-hmm.
And this being like the third or fourth one I've read, I remember them having titles. And because it's so unusual, because most authors don't do that.
Right.
Even there's an author named Scott Smith who actually writes a book. He doesn't even have chapters. He just goes, the whole book is just one long. I think it's that, The Ruins, I think it's called. It's just one long book.
Perhaps the content of the book lends itself to that. I think in terms of scenes. It's almost like if you were writing a film script and, you're writing a scene and that scene is kind of self-contained. And I think that's the way I think about the chapters.
Now, the cover, I can't get over this cover, how dark and it's an odd cover, but yet it catches the eye at the same time. Is this a real place on the cover?
Oh, I don't know. The cover design people at Counterpoint came up with that. All I know about that cover is that I think it's perfect.
Kelly Winton is the one who designed the cover.
Yeah.
It doesn't say if this place actually exists. You can see it down in the middle of nowhere.
It would appear to be some kind of photograph. So I'm not sure, but it's. I think that the cover is right because it evokes the feeling of what I was trying to do in words.
Wolf Lake. There is no Wolf Lake in real life, right? I mean, this is fiction, but I mean, is it based on anything real?
Well, it's not based on anything real any more than any of my books are. They're all really total works of fiction. I've never been a take it from the headlines kind of writer. The plots for the books kind of take shape in my mind. I'm not quite sure exactly how. And then they end up in settings that feel right to me. I mean, I had some connection with the Adirondacks in that ages ago when I was a little kid, I used to go there with my mother on vacations. And so I have this kind of visceral sense of what the Adirondacks are like, or at least what my memory of them is like. And I wanted a setting different from the setting in the first four books, which is a kind of a more pastoral, rolling hills, Catskill setting. I wanted something a little darker, a little lonelier, and I think there are, wilderness areas of the Adirondacks that fit that pretty well.
Right. It seems like it's easy for you to write books, or easy to a certain extent. It seems like you get ideas pretty simple, pretty easily. Is that true?
Well, I guess, I don't really associate ease or difficulty with it so much. That's a hard one to explain, David. I don't try to come up with ideas. It's not like I'm straining for a plot concept. Things pop into my head, and you know, typically my approach is I always carry a half a dozen index cards around with me in my shirt pocket. I mean, I've been doing that now.
Really?
I've been doing that since I wrote Think of a Number, because that's ideas don't come to me when I sit down and try to have an idea. Typically, I think maybe most of my ideas have come to me when I'm driving somewhere, and I'll just pull over. Take these little cards out of my pocket and make a few notes. And a lot of these notes end up being useless. They don't, they're not coherent with anything else. But ultimately, that's the way these things take shape. I end up with a bunch of notes. They kind of fit together. And then I guess when I try to start stitching them together, plot possibilities occur to me. There's an upside and a downside to this. The downside is I'm a very anxious guy. I hate to use the word paranoid, but sometimes, the way my mind works, I think about something that could happen, and then, oh my goodness, what could happen as a result of that? Oh, and if that happened, oh my God, look at what could happen over here.
Sort of like the domino effect.
Yeah, it's like that. And that stuff, it just seems to be the way my brain is wired. And it doesn't necessarily end up with me having a happy day, but it can end up with a lot of good notes for some, maybe present or future plot ideas.
The very opening chapter, there's a very interesting scene at a frozen lake. I don't want to give anything away, but...
Yeah.
Very, very. And then right away we're like, well, how does this relate to the story? I like a lot of that's plot that some of the, a lot of the authors, I've seen other authors do it this way. Well, they'll put a chapter in the beginning, and then you're wondering how it relates to the main part of the book. And then
Yes. As
you go along, you figure it out. And of course, we figured this out a little later on. But it's interesting how that was. And I'm like, well, who is this guy? What? It's sort of like a teaser kind of thing. Is that the way it's meant?
Yeah, it's really two things for me, David. It's yes, it is a teaser, but generally speaking, those initial snippets or little one page prologues or there's one in each of the books that I've done. I like it as a technique because in some cases it's a way of giving just a kind of a little flashbulb view of the villain. In this particular case, it's not. It's a flashbulb view, but it's of something that happened in the past that's going to have implications for the future.
Huge implications, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I just find it a very useful technique. Some writers or editors will, are against prologues. They kind of think, you don't want a prologue. You just want to start the story. But And maybe that's true. If I pick up a book and it's got a 12-page prologue, I find that like a stopper. It's like I feel like I'm being given, a bunch of facts I need to know before I start to read the book, and that doesn't excite me. That's why I try to keep them to like one page, because then it becomes, as I say, like a little flashbulb that shows you something, and that hopefully you're going to remember it as you go on through the book.
I think it being shorter is much, much, much better than having it, like you said, a 12-page one.
Mm-hmm.
People are like, let's start this. And you just, when you're reading the prologue, you feel like you really haven't started the book. That you have, but you haven't hit chapter one yet. So everybody, when you're reading chapter one, you feel like you've really started the book.
And that's exactly the way I feel. Again, David, it's an odd thing. It's almost like the effect of short chapters versus long chapters. But I have exactly the same feeling. I open up a book, if I see a prologue that's going on and on, my immediate impression is, come on, let's get to the story. Let's get to it.
Now, this is book five. Now, does Counterpoint want you to write a lot more books in this series?
I think they would. I mean, I do have a contract with them for the next one, which I'm working on now.
Oh, wonderful. All right. I'm hoping they want 20, 30 of them, you know.
I think that's all going to depend, but we'll see, you know.
It's interesting, though. We have authors today who, I guess, they write their notes down, and then when if something should happen to them, God forbid anything happens to you, but if something's happened, somebody can pick up and write the story. But how do you do that when you don't know the writing style? I mean, how do you duplicate a writing style? I don't know how you deal with it. I have
no idea. I mean, it would never occur to me to, you know, to store notes for some future writer, because so much of this stuff just comes out of my own head, my own feelings. You know, I put myself in a situation. You know, I imagine how David might feel in a situation, how his wife might feel, what they'd say to each other. I mean, I don't know how you make notes for something like that.
And then being stuck in this not really a cabin, it's more like a mountain house, right?
Yeah, a big old lodge.
Lodge, there's the word I need. Yeah. But then being stuck there with the temperature and or the weather the way it is, it's kind of interesting. But you know, that I always thought of going up on those mountains and those winding roads and how slippery the roads would be, and that scares me to death sometimes. Think about that. It's so easy, you could just slide right off the mountain, you know, and oof, you know, it's a scary thing.
Yes, it can be, and I think that's part of what a setting like that does with a story. If you want to, you know, if there's an aspect of the story that's going to become essentially a thriller, then there are certain things that have to happen. And I think one of the things is that the characters can't have instant total access to safety. You know, they have to be in some kind of situation where they're isolated either emotionally or they're isolated physically. You know, they can't just call in the cavalry. They're in a situation that they have to deal with based on their own personal resources. And I think that creates tension, and stories are about conflict, they're about tension, so settings can play a big part in that.
Now, you had a title called Peter Pan Must Die. That was the one before. What a terrific title! I mean, what was essentially that book about? That's one of the few I have not read or not yet.
The Peter Pan book.
Yeah,
that was about a woman who is arrested, tried, and convicted for the murder of her politician husband, and it comes to light that there may have been some irregularities in the trial. There may have been some irregularities with the investigator who was assigned to it. And anyway, Dave Gurney and his pal Jack Hardwick get involved in probing that. And the story ultimately, the Peter Pan character is an assassin. And he has a Greek name, Petros Panikos, and the name Petros Panikos, Peter Pan, becomes a kind of a nickname for the name of the assassin, who also happens to be a very small man with a very childlike appearance, and so the Peter Pan concept kind of works with that too.
Right. Now, is that a whodunit also?
Oh yeah, they're all Dave Gurney getting to the bottom of the mess and figuring out who done it. Yep.
There are some, but whodunit, it has to, for me, if I read a mystery, I want it to be a whodunit. I don't. Some people, there are authors who like to do why dunits or different things. But I, if you know who it is all along, I don't know, it kind of spoils it for me.
I agree with that.
That's why I couldn't watch Columbo, you know? I didn't want to know who it was. I mean, if you know the whole time, but the fun with Columbo was getting how he got there, how he really got them in the end, which is, there's a point to that, but I don't know. Mysteries to me should be whodunits.
I agree with you, and mine, I think, are a couple of things. Yeah, they're whodunits, because generally speaking, you don't know until the end, you know, who the bad guy really is. But there's also in mind too an element of why done it or how done it. You know, there's a question not only of a who, but sometimes it's surprising to discover what the motive was. And there's a how done it thing part of it too. But, you know, like, well, you've mentioned think of a number a few times, and so this killer who seems to be able to read his victims' minds, there's definitely a how involved in that, which, you know, doesn't become revealed until later in the book. But I kind of agree with you. I don't like knowing who did it at the beginning. That kind of takes the
but the
know,
fact that Columbo would match wits with these famous people. You know,
yeah.
One of them was Patrick McGoohan, and I think he even did Jack Cassidy. Well, they had all these different celebrities. Guests who would match wits with him, try to elude his process, you know, and
right.
And they think they have it, and then right before he leaves, he says, "Oh, just one more thing," you know.
Yeah, exactly, and it's a pleasant formula, I think, and it can be enjoyable. It's about as far as you can get from a thriller, though. There's
right.
There's no sense of fear in any of those stories.
Yeah, you know right away. I mean, they're pretty blatant about who it is right away. But there is actually a Columbo episode where there was a whodunit. Only one, though. I think they did one episode where it was a whodunit, and apparently it was very good. I haven't seen it, but I have heard about it. But I mean, that's what made Perry Mason so wonderful. You know, you didn't know who did it till the very end, but you knew he was getting closer and closer. Is it? But your books are, I mean, Think of a Number was just so interesting with the numbers. I mean, the numbers are what got to me in that book. And I just fell in love with Dave and Matt. We haven't talked about Madeline yet. Madeline's got a lot of, something's bothering Madeline in Wolf Lake. Big time.
Oh, yeah.
Big
very
time.
Definitely.
And she's acting weird.
Oh, yes. Very weird indeed. The thing about Madeline in this book, and it was part of my initial idea for the book, was that in the first four books, Madeline has been, in a sense, this kind of very strong presence in Dave's life. She's been a person kind of in touch with the daily reality of living. She's been insightful. She's been basically a beacon of light and a pillar of strength for her husband. What occurred to me was that people in general are a bit more complicated than that. And in everybody's life and in everybody's past, there are events and feelings that they would perhaps rather not talk about. You know, in some form or other, you know, we all have some kind of secrets. And I thought, well, let me apply that notion to Madeline and let's see. What could we find in Madeline's past that could play a role in a
It's a whopper too.
Huh?
I said it's a whopper too.
Oh yeah, it's a whopper. And sure, it's a big thing. And so I try to find a way that there would be a certain kind of event in her past that could play a role both in her present relationship with Dave and also in the murder plot of the story. And I don't want to talk any more about what the event is,
right.
Because that turns out to be perhaps a bit of a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to just come at Madeline from a different angle and show her as a more vulnerable person than we had come to believe she was.
Well, in the first four, at least the first couple books, she really wants Dave to herself. She wants him to, you know, stay home, and she wants to be with him, which is very understandable. She doesn't want him to go back to work. She doesn't want him to have that thing that takes him away from her. She doesn't like that. She's very possessive.
Yes.
It's almost like they're just married, you know?
Well, in a way, yes, because their move to the country, they're coming up to the mountains after, you know, she leaves. She's been a social worker in the city. She leaves that job. He leaves the New York Police Department after 25 years. And I think Madeline has hopes for a new life. And in a way, David, I mean, that kind of is a way of saying what you just said, that, she sees it as a new beginning, almost like they're just getting married, starting out on a new life. And she had these hopes and expectations. Dave, I think, maybe had shared a little bit of that. Maybe he had this feeling that for 25 years in the police department, he'd been absorbed in that work, and he has this feeling, oh, maybe after I'm retired, I can pay a little more attention to Madeline. But they move up to the country, and what he really discovers is that, well, he isn't all that flexible. He can't turn into a different kind of person to make her happy. And so he's kind of hanging on to his homicide investigations, even in retirement.
He can't let go of that. He just can't let go. No matter what happens, he always comes back to that, and it's something he can't say no to.
It turns out in his life to be much more a part of who he is than he realized. It wasn't a job in the city. It was who he was. And just because he moved to the country, he doesn't stop being who he was. And so there's that tension and essentially disappointment, where Madeline, you know, was kind of hoping this is going to be a different kind of guy, but he's not.
It's interesting. I mean, these books take, what, for you, a couple of years to write? It seems like you have
I'd say so, yeah. I mean, some people, I've been amazed at how quickly some people can turn out a series where they're writing, a book every 6 months or at least, a book every year. No, these take a bit longer. I'd say a minimum of 18 months and more comfortably 2 years.
Right. And that means you're taking your time and doing it right, which is really good. I mean, you have authors that churn out books so fast nowadays, my head spins on some of them, and we all know who I'm talking about, I think. But I mean, a little, like one a month is a little ridiculous, but, that's just the way it is. I mean, it seems like quality suffers sometimes because of that. Because if you're churning out books that fast, how good can they be?
Yeah, I guess some of them are pretty formulaic, so that they're just kind of maybe plugging a few new characters into the basic structure. My impression is that some of the romance writers can churn them out pretty quickly. But it's not a genre I know anything about. Well, all I know is that when I get into these things, they get pretty complicated in my head, and I would find it hard to rush them.
One of the most spectacular books I've ever read, and it's a classic, and then there were none, is one of the, I mean, the whodunit in that one is just amazing. I remember reading that book and actually becoming frightened at one point because of the way the setting was, Oh my goodness! There's nobody left to be the murderer. Who could it be? And you're terrified. And then that thing falls off the balcony. The big statue is pushed off, and you're like, well, wait a minute. There's nobody left. Who's pushing that thing off? It really that sense of fear. Like what's going on? How in the world is this going to be resolved?
Right.
I mean, that's an all-time classic. I mean, you just can't match anything like that.
There's a certain magic to a number of books that I've read, and the one I always mention to people, it's a bit old, I suppose, but I absolutely love Hound of the Baskervilles, and I guess technically it's a novel, but it's a very very short one.
Mm-hmm.
It's very concise, but. To me, the mood of it is wonderful. It has that kind of an eerie quality. It's set out on the moors in England, and it's just, it has everything. If somebody wanted to learn how to be a mystery writer, I'd advise them to read Hound of the Baskervilles a half a dozen times and see how it's put together. But I guess we all have our favorites.
Right, the whodunits there. There's one by Val McDermott called A Place of Execution, which really threw me. When she reveals the ending of that book, I was just totally floored. And to this day, it's one of those ones that I always mention of Evil because it's just so wonderful. Having a good ending is everything. And if you don't have a good ending, it can ruin the whole book.
Well, that's true, sure.
So you have to... Everything has to make perfect sense, which makes your job as a writer that much more difficult.
Well, it has to make perfect sense, but on the other hand, very often, if we're writing thrillers, we're writing stuff that's a little exaggerated, a little pumped up. It's not just, all shades of gray and, it's standard, newspaper story kind of thing. We're amping up the contrast a bit, we're amping up the color a bit, and then to make that believable and satisfying, that is the challenge.
Now, do you think your readers have followed you to your new publishing company? Do you think they know that you're still there?
Oh, I think so, because, if you go to Amazon, the publishing company is a relatively small issue on an Amazon page. So if people look up John Verdon and they look up Wolf Lake, they're going to find it as easily as they found any of my other books.
People who are dedicated are know how to do that, what to look for and where to go and how to find things. But
sure,
sometimes I find that there are fans out there who don't know. They're like, oh, they have a new book, I didn't know that. It's hard to get the word around to everybody. There's always somebody who doesn't know. So
I'm not that much of a social media guy, so maybe I don't do as much of that kind of promotion as some people do. But it's certainly the news certainly gets out on my Facebook page, and I think it gets out on the.
Well, there you go. So where you're set. Tell me who Naomi is. You wrote this book for Naomi.
Oh, that's my wife.
Yeah, that would have been my first guess.
Yes, and I think she also has gotten the picture credit wherever there's a photograph of me too. She's taken the so-called author photographs.
Now, is she anything like Madeline?
She's warmer and funnier than Madeline. I think she has certain things in common with her. My wife loves being out in the country here. I mean, we're in a very rural part of upstate New York here, and my wife just loves walking out into the woods and in the winter snowshoeing out there. I mean, she shares all of that enthusiasm with Madeline. When we moved here, it was just, the ideal place. So she has all of that. I think she's much more patient with me than Madeline was, perhaps, in the early books with Dave. And the aspect of my wife that I don't really depict much in Madeline is my wife has got a wonderful sense of humor, and it's an absolute delight being with her.
Right. That's nice. It really is nice. And Madeline can be a little rough around the edges sometimes, antisocial, I would say.
That's true. And there's a reason for that, too, and that is that if you don't have conflict in a scene, you don't have much. So, in order to make sure there's a sufficiently lively dynamic going on between Madeline and Dave, sometimes she gets a little edgy.
There's a tremendous bathroom scene in this book with Madeline that we can't talk about because it'll give something away. But what happens in that bathroom, you're never going to forget. I can tell you that right now. If you haven't read the book, everybody's running out to buy the book now.
That's a great teaser, David.
It's a great scene too. It has ramifications but that's the kind of thing that there. In your books, there's always something that happens that's memorable. I mean, and the opening scene is memorable in this book too. That's another scene that it's going to go through my mind every time I see. Well, I can't even say that. I won't even go there. But you may know what I was thinking. But it's the memorable scenes are what make a book fun. You have to be able to see these things happen in your mind.
Sure.
And if you don't, some writers are better at it than others. atmosphere is very important. You have to, I mean, when you're reading a book, it said, say it's set in France, you have to feel like you're in France.
Yes.
Or exactly. It doesn't work. And I know a lot of times when some of these authors write books and they're set overseas, you know, it's kind of a general thing and they're more interested in the characters. But I think the overall feeling has to be there, or you lose a sense of the book. That's just my feeling, anyway.
I agree with you, David, because I think part of the joy of reading is to step into another world, and there have to be vivid aspects of that world, or you're nowhere.
Right, and sometimes you just relate to the characters. Now Hardwick is a very fun guy.
Hardwick.
Hardwick's got a rough edge around. He doesn't take any BS at all. He's very very, and he doesn't like to be pushed around either. So he's an interesting. He and Dave, I don't know what the word is. Their interplay together is really fun to listen to and listen. It's really read is what I mean. But
I think they make a nice odd couple, in the sense that David is obviously a. Kind of a little smoother, a more polite, restrained.
Kind They're sort of a Holmes and Watson kind of thing. I mean, David being the smarter one, but.
But if you had a Watkins who was a little rougher edged.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Hardwick is more than the one that likes to go around. He likes to drive around and find the suspects and interview the suspects. That kind of a thing. He kind of likes. Doing that more of the police work. David seems to be more of the thinker. One to use his brain and figure it out that way.
I guess
years of being in the police department have made him. Do you get tired of being around people?
Well, I think he's a natural introvert too, and most of what he's good at is taking those facts that are uncovered, however they are uncovered, and taking those facts and kind of running them through that little mental computer of his and seeing how they fit together. I mean, that's what he's good at. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think Hardwick is probably pretty good confronting people.
You get to write these amazing characters. I mean, these complex characters. Are we going to find out more about Hardwick in future books, do you think?
Well, he's the one who has been almost like Madeline in the first book. He's been very present, but all we know about him so far is kind of the way he is right now. And so it might be an interesting thing in the next book to look at, wait a minute, what was this guy like when he was a teenager? And how did he get to be the way he is? That's a very interesting notion, David.
Right. So is that really the way it's going to be in book six? It's going to focus on his younger years?
No, not book six, but maybe book seven.
Oh wow, interesting. I think I may have given you an idea. I think getting these backstories on the characters is important. You feel like you know them more, and that's what makes these. But it has to be something believable. You can't drop something really tremendous and say, well, this is what happened when he was two or something.
Yeah,
and not have it make sense. It's got to fit into something. You can't say, well, maybe he killed five people when he was younger. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense if you did that. You don't want to make it too horrific.
You have to draw a line. You have to, there has to be a credible connection between the past and the present. But it would be, I think it would be revealing of the character if the past was a little different from what you might have at first expected.
Now, how many years do you imagine that Madeline and Dave have been married?
When I write each book, I have to figure it out because they generally refer back to something. But I'm thinking that they've been married about 25 years.
Yeah, I was going to say it seems like they're very comfortable with each other.
And yeah, David had a first marriage, which only lasted a couple of years, and that's where his son Kyle, who pops up in some of the books, came from. And then with his marriage to Madeline, they they had the son who was killed when he was 4 years old. That's a factor that pops up in a number of the books as well. But yeah, they've been married. You know, the exact.
So they're very damaged. Both
of
them.
Oh sure.
Definitely. I mean, they're very. You can't lose a son if he's four and not be totally damaged by it. You never recover from that.
Especially in David's case, where he blames himself for what happened.
And it's interesting how they say that after something happens to a child, that a lot of couples break up because they can't deal with that reminder every day of looking at each other and knowing, you know, maybe it was my fault or, it's a horrible, horrible thing. I think about that couple in Florida whose son got eaten by the alligator, and every day I think about what would that be like to go through something like that. And the most beautiful child in the world, and just suddenly gone, you can't even imagine the horror and how you would ever function totally after that.
Right.
In a moment, things change, and it sounds so trite, and yet it's so true. And God, the pain and the suffering that those poor parents had gone through. You know, and they'll blame themselves forever.
No, I understand, yes.
God,
perhaps
it's horrible.
Perhaps nothing worse than the death of a child.
Now, do you have children of your own?
Well, I have children, but you wouldn't call them children. I mean...
Well, I didn't ask you how old you were, so I...
No, my children are basically, approaching middle age.
Now, are they writers? Any interest in writing on their part?
No, not as far as I know. Well, my daughter occasionally gets into writing something, a little story or that kind of thing, but not a great deal. I mean, I think probably for her it's an interesting little thing that she likes to do from time to time. I also have two sons. I don't think they have much interest in writing.
It's interesting when you read a really well written book. It always amazes me how the authors do it, because it isn't easy. I've read a lot of books, and I've read some really boring, slow books, and then I've read ones that really got me. And those are the ones you want to read every time. And when you do that, I told you about that book, What She Knew, which is just absolutely tremendous. And there's something about that book when you read it, you completely get involved in it, and the fun that you have reading that book is amazing. I mean, it's like nothing you've ever experienced for that one. But the problem is, once you've done it, you want another one exactly like that.
Yeah. Well, there's a magic to certain books, I think, David, and the magic, I think, is partly in the book, and it's partly in the relationship between the book and the way that particular reader's mind works, and the book just seems perfect. You know, it's the author's, perhaps the author's pacing is exactly the pacing that your brain likes. You know, the choice of words is a choice of words that's very, you know, comfortable and vivid to you. And when you put a lot of that together, all of a sudden, my God, I love that book.
And I thought that way of think of a number. I just thought that was written, the way it was written with all the numbers and trying to figure out what the numbers meant was fascinating. Absolutely, just fascinating. And it totally got me. That's what got me onto your series. But then your characters are interesting too. So that, and if you have that balance really well done, it can really make a great series.
Well, I appreciate the way you feel about them.
Well, I'm sure you have a lot of fans who feel the same way. I mean, it's something that. Are you on ebook too for this one?
Oh yes, sure. Yeah, it's available. It's available now as a. I guess a hardcover. It's available as an ebook, and it's available, you know, in that Audible format.
Mm-hmm. Now, has there been any interest in TV or movies for this character?
A while ago, I think probably now three, maybe almost 4 years ago, there were some kind of intense discussions with some fairly serious people out in Hollywood. And then, of course, it came up against the obstruction of money and trying to get a a financial commitment from a distributor. We were a bit between a rock and a hard place because we had a very high-quality group of people involved who would only do it if it was, you know, a top-quality production. They wanted to do it, by the way, as a TV miniseries rather than as a film. Mm-hmm. And the money involved in it became the obstacle. And, you know, I guess I still have some kind of vague, maybe unrealistic, but I still have some vague hope that at some point somebody's going to say, hey, you know, we found a way to get the money, let's do it.
Now, were they going to film the first book?
They were going to do all of them.
Oh.
They were going to take all of them and do it as a an ongoing TV thing. But, as I said, that kind of came apart on the reef of financing.
Right. Well, I hope it gets back on track. It would be fascinating to really see Dave and Madeline come alive on the screen. I mean, that would be amazing.
I'd love to see it, and I think my kids would love to see it, too.
Yeah, it would be great. So, number six, does it have a title yet?
It has a, well, you know, I'm always kind of tentative about these things because the titles that I come up with are half the time they're not the title it ends up with.
Well, what did you come up with at first for Wolf Lake?
Beware of the Wolf.
Beware of the, yeah, that doesn't work as well.
And that turned into Wolf Lake. And I forget now, I had a whole bunch. I think I had about 50 different title possibilities for Think of a Number, but that title, Think of a Number, actually was a suggestion by my editor at Random House at the time. So the titles come from different places, different times, mm-hmm. And I don't know, you're probably aware of this, but ultimately the title really isn't considered as an author responsibility. It's considered to be part of the marketing package of the book. It's almost like cover design.
Right.
And it's the publisher really who's got, you know, the sway over the title.
And that's what shocked me about John Sanford. He told me when I interviewed him one time, he never picks the titles of his books.
Yeah.
And I was totally floored. You're the author. How could you not pick your title? It makes no sense to me.
As an author, I think we always suggest a title, but then half the time it turns into something else.
So we don't even get a little hint about what the next title is going to be. Oh, well, it was worth a try.
Well, it's good. If I mentioned it, nobody would remember it because the book.
They'll say, "Well, he didn't use that title. He never should have said that title to begin with." You know, and they'll think you're some kind of idiot for even mentioning a title that doesn't even exist. And people will go to bookstores asking for a title that isn't even there. It's like,
so we'll avoid that problem.
I remember when I asked Mary Higgins Clark one time when I went to see her at a signing what her next book was going to be called, and she said, I think she said Remember House or something, and it didn't turn out to be that title. She completely changed the title by the time mm-hmm. the book came out, and it was a better title actually. But you know, that's what happens. Things change all the time. And I know
well,
that.
The other thing too is that my books are actually sold in quite a few other countries in translation, and the publishers in those other countries come up with whatever title they think is going to work best in their country.
Well, what were the other titles for Think of a Number? Do you remember?
I don't remember the other. I can't. Well, let me think.
I'm just curious. What it's always fascinating to see what the other countries.
Well, I tell you, the one of the huge differences was with Wolf Lake. In this country, it's Wolf Lake. In Spain, where they actually published the book before they published it here, my Spanish publisher was very eager to get it, but their title in Spanish is Controlaré tus sueños, which means I will control your dreams.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah.
That's interesting.
So
they must have really liked your book. To put it out
my Spanish publisher is very, very devoted to the series, and the books actually do remarkably well in Spain.
Now, is there any difference between the books at all? Are there little differences with wording or anything? Between countries?
You mean between my the American edition and,
yes,
and the foreign edition?
Yes.
Well, they're all translated, but you know, they're translated very often into languages that I can't read, so I really don't know how perfect the translations are.
See.
I mean, with certainly a contractual promise that they're going to be accurate and literal and so forth, but so I really don't know. I can't answer your question, David. I can only assume that they are what they should be.
Yeah, exactly. Now, can we expect a book next year?
I'm thinking that this book I'm working on now, I'm imagining I'm going to be finishing it probably in the late spring, probably sometime next May.
Okay.
Now, that would mean that at the earliest it would probably be a November December book.
Oh wow! So we got a long way.
Oh yeah, well that's the problem. If you're a guy who like me who writes one book every 2 years, they don't come all that fast.
We're gonna have to let you go and finish your book quicker so you can get it out quicker.
Okay.
Well, we love the series, so we want more. I mean, it's like when you read a series and you read the last one, you kind of feel like, oh, I wish there were more.
Well, that's the way I felt about a couple of series. I read all of Reginald Hill's books.
Oh yeah, and, I think he died just recently. Yeah.
Yeah, he did.
Poor man.
A year or two ago, and he wrote 24 of the D.L. Pascoe books. I read all the 24, and I would have been very happy if there was going to be a 25th. And then there's another British writer who I read everything he wrote, and I wish there was more, and that's Peter Robinson.
Oh, yeah.
Peter
Robinson has a new book out.
The latest one I read was, I think, called Children of the Revolution.
No, there's one coming if it's not already.
One after that?
It's got a Ferris wheel on the cover, and I can't remember. When the Music's Over? I can't remember. I'm not sure if that's the title or not. Yeah, I've interviewed him. He's a fascinating man. Very nice man, too.
Well, that's good news, because I will welcome a new Peter Robinson book.
Yeah, I know. I saw it somewhere. I couldn't tell you the exact title. The titles don't always stay in my head unless it's somebody. Your titles stay in my head because I have just seen them so many times, I guess. But
right.
And I have enjoyed them. When you enjoy them, you remember a title better.
Yes, that's true.
But I know there's a new one coming, so you'll be happy to hear that. But
thank you.
Anybody else besides those two?
Besides us two, in terms of series stuff?
Yeah, the series that you read every one of. Banks.
I don't know if I've read all of the Harry Bosch books, but I like them a lot. All that police procedural detail, there's a nice sense of grounding in those books.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I find them very credible.
Harry is very. People do things to Harry a lot.
Harry's not an easy guy.
No, he's not. But you don't think of that while you're reading it. I mean, I don't. I just think of Harry as a hero, sort of. And
yeah, he's a hero, but he's a kind of an edgy hero.
He is edgy, but you know what? I guess in your mind, you always think, well, that's the way he should be. It's his right to be that way,
or something like that. It's quite credible, sure.
But it's. I don't think of him as being that obnoxious, but maybe he is. Now that you say that,
I don't know if he's obnoxious, but I just don't think he's.
He's a rabble rouser. Would that be better?
Well, I don't know. Just not a particularly easy guy to get along with.
We should get Michael Connelly on and ask his opinion.
Yeah. But anyway, so I like those books a lot. And then I also usually, because my wife suggests it, I'll read stuff that has absolutely nothing to do with the genre at all. And she'll recommend something to me, and outside of the mystery thriller field completely, but. There was a book I read, oh Lord, when was it? Probably about a year ago, by William Trevor, an Irish writer.
Oh, I think I've heard of him. Yeah, I think.
And he wrote. He's written several novels, but this particular one was called Fools of Fortune, and it has to do with the Irish uprising back in the early part of the 20th century, back in 1920, in that area.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing of it is, he's a beautiful writer. The man cannot write a bad sentence. You know, you read this book, and there's not a wasted word in it. I mean, he's just a wonderful writer. He's got nothing to do with thrillers, nothing to do with mysteries. He's just a beautiful writer. So occasionally, you know, I find myself diverted out of the genre into something that's, you know, not the kind of thing I write, but absolutely beautiful.
Right, exactly. Which is great. I mean, you can't limit. I mean, I think it's better if you don't limit yourself. You just find these beautiful things. I mean, there's a lot of wonderful writers out there, maybe not in the genre that you usually read, but you know, you can find a gem, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I remember I read a book by Margaret Atwood called Blind Assassin, which really, really was good. And I wouldn't normally read Margaret Atwood. I don't know why, but mm-hmm. I did, and I found myself enjoying it tremendously.
Right. A pleasant surprise.
Yeah, and it's always a risk when you... I hate to use the word risk, but it's always... when you pick up a new writer, you don't know what you're getting into. And especially if you're buying the book, you don't know if you're going to like the writer. What if you don't like the writer?
Yep.
What if they do nothing for you and you spend all that money and... then what do you do? Well, you can always take the book back a lot of times. But, you know, you want to be sure that you're going to be able to get into the book, that it's going
to
be interesting.
Well, that's the advantage of a series, you know. And if I get this new Peter Robinson book, I'm not taking any risk. I know Peter Robinson, you know.
Right. I find that way, that series that you talk about, like with Charles Todd, his Ian Rutledge series is so good. I've read every one in that series, and every one is enjoyable. And there's something about that series that I can't get enough of, and they're such wonderful people. I don't know if you've ever met the Todds before, but they're such, and he's the guy, the main guy who writes the book. It's him and his mother that write it together.
I was on a panel with him years ago, and I forget now what it was.
He's one of the most unusual men you'll ever meet. He's very, very unusual.
I think it might have been Boucher Khan or something like that. But we were on a panel together, and I don't remember a great deal about him, but I do remember sitting at the same table.
Yeah, he's a very interesting character, and he's got. And you ask him a question, he gives you a very detailed answer, but it's very interesting what he says half the time. I love the way his mind works. For some reason, he's just this interesting, intricate guy. You know, he's not your everyday guy. He's very unusual. I know that he used to work for a company before he started writing, but they've been writing books for years, and they do such a great job of it. And you know, I think the Ian Rutledge series is stronger for me. It's the better series. I don't know why. Well, I guess we all have favorites.
Well, yeah, it all depends on how they fit into our own heads.
I mean, how do you feel when one of your fans will say to you, "Well, I didn't like this book, but I loved your other ones"? Does that bother you?
I'd like to say it didn't, but I think like a lot of writers, I'm probably more sensitive to criticism than I'd like to be.
Right.
You know.
I have felt, especially lately, that I would be a good person to bounce a book off of. If somebody had completed a book and say, "I wanted to get your opinion on it," I think I'd be good at that. Because
mm-hmm.
I would give an honest answer. And
well, it's an honest answer, but it's an honest answer informed by, you know, our own individual personalities and how the book resonates with us personally.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, if I read 10 reviews of my book that are positive and one that's negative, I mean, guess which one I'm going to think about for the next week.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of authors and celebrities don't read their reviews. They don't want to be. They don't want to feel that way. You know, but
yeah,
you're
going to
get eventually. You're going to get a bad review as a writer or as an entertainer or whatever you are. There's going to be something, but you know, it's not like you can it's getting past that that makes, you know, you just do what you need to do. You do what's going to earn you a good living and something you can enjoy doing.
Right.
And you know, if you can't worry about what other people think.
Sit down at the keyboard and do the work.
Right. If indeed there's something that you're doing blatantly wrong and you can change and it's going to make you a better, you know, writer, entertainer, whatever you are, go for it, definitely. But, you know, that's why you have agents.
Yes.
And that's why you have editors who know what you need to do.
Exactly.
Or have done it before. I'm sure Wolf Lake in its first draft was longer than it is, the 370 some pages it is at the end.
Yes, it was about 80 pages longer.
Right. So they know what to take out without ruining any part of the book. And it's easy to ruin a book if you take out the wrong parts.
It's not just a matter of not ruining it. Very often when you take it out, it does something magical for the pacing, too.
As long as the reader can't tell what you've taken out. Yeah,
you don't want there to be a big gap, right?
You don't want that, oh, wait a minute, something's missing here. It's like sometimes you watch a movie on TV and you can see where it's been edited.
Yes.
And it's like, oh, I don't want to know that.
Yes.
And they take something out and they ruin what is there to begin with. Anyway, we have to let you go because
we've
been doing this for an hour, so it's hard to believe.
Well, it's been a very pleasant hour, David. Thank you.
It's been wonderful. The new book, again, is called Wolf Lake, and it's out from Counterpoint Books. It's in audio. I'm sure. Is there an audio version of this?
Yes.
There is an audio version. Who reads the audio? Do you remember?
I believe his name is Christopher Lane.
Christopher Lane. Okay. So you get an audio, you get an e-book all over the place, all over Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever, whatever's closest to you. And it's been great fun to talk to you, John Verdon. And I can't wait for book six.
Thank you, David. We'll be in touch.
And this has been David's Book Talk, and we'll talk to you next time.
You have just enjoyed the podcast of David's Book Talk, brought to you by your host, book lover David English. Please visit us at davidsbooktalk.com, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and subscribe to our podcast. We want to hear from you, and we don't want you to miss our upcoming shows with top authors like Mary Higgins Clark, Patricia Cornwell, Lisa Scottolini, Jackie Collins, Nelson DeMille, Michael Connelly, Sue Grafton, Steve Martini, Dale Brown, David Baldacci.